Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, July 21st, welcome to the show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
Three welcomes. I'm Avi Wolfman.
It's back, Avi.
It's back. I love it. The triple welcome. Mm-hmm. I'll add my final welcome, and I'll tell you about the topic of the show today, which is the big E, the economy. Is it a good economy right now? Is it a bad economy right now? Is it somewhere in between? We're going to talk about the economy. We're going to examine the state of the U.S. economy from many different perspectives today. I'm very excited about our guests. We have Heather Long, who used to be with the Washington Post, now is chief economist at Navy Federal Credit Union. And we also have Patrick Harker, who until very recently was our neighbor, former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, you know, in the room for a lot of those big conversations about the state of the American economy. So they're our main guests today in our main segments. Just going to talk about the economy, folks. Cherry.
Yeah, a lot of questions I have. I'm confused, as a lot of people are.
Sure.
Is it good? Is it bad? You know, and we're going to try to figure this out.
Is it happy? Is it sad?
Is it?
I don't know. How is the economy feeling for you right
yes.
now? That's what we want to know. Mm-hmm. Are you spending, saving, changing your financial habits? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, hello.
Hi.
Drop your comment right there in the chat. But first, a trio of local news stories. Cherry, start us off today.
Yeah, we're going over the bridge. New Jersey Democrats, they are speaking out in opposition after the Trump administration has signaled that it will soon begin housing detained immigrants at the Joint Base McGuire-Dix-Lakehurst, also known as Fort Dix. Both the New Jersey senators and all nine of Jersey House Democrats, they signed a joint letter. They called the plan to house immigrants at Fort Dix a, quote, inappropriate use of our national defense system and military resources. If you didn't know, Fort Dix is home to a low security prison that houses about 4,000 individuals. That's according to the FCI Dix website. And all of this drama started to bubble up last week when Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth unveiled this plan to members of Congress. The secretary said that, you know, housing immigrants there would not affect military operations. But of course, folks snapped back. They said, look, it'll become very opaque.
Mm-hmm.
Lawyers won't have access to provide support for people detained there. And it will be harder to just hold people accountable or to monitor the conditions there. And so this is also, Avi, becoming a point of contention in the gubernatorial race there in New Jersey as well.
Yeah, not surprised at all. And I'll point out that Fort Dix is in the congressional district of a Democrat, Herb
yes.
Conaway.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting angle here. He used to work at the Air Force Base as a doctor, so he has personal experience there. He's really ringing a lot of alarm bells. He also spoke with NJ Spotlight when this news initially broke and said he felt like this was the precursor to ramped up immigration enforcement in this region.
Yeah,
because if there's more detention facilities, more beds, then they will go out and detain more people. And
yeah.
so that's something to watch for as well, because, you know, capacity has restrained, I would imagine, some of the immigration enforcement so far in our region. And Conaway is saying, watch out. This could be step one to a step two.
And by the way, New Jersey is currently home to two private facilities. They have Delaney Hall in Newark, New Jersey, as well as the Elizabeth Detention Center. And so people in New Jersey are very sensitive to this issue. And this would be a third.
Yeah. Story number two now. And I love this piece, Cherry, in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a new exhibition here in Philadelphia that celebrates a pioneering black artist who seemingly disappeared in the late 1980s. The artist's name is Mavis Pusey. She was born in Jamaica, ended up being pretty prominent on the NYC art scene in and around the 1970s. Then in the late 80s, she kind of just vanished.
Yeah.
And curators recently spent about a decade trying to track her down and to find some of her work. It turns out Pusey had moved to rural Virginia, and a couple of curators found her just before she died in 2019. They also used a combination of court records and internet searches and eBay searches to gather over 80 pieces of her art that had been strewn all over the place for a show. that's now open at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia. And so it's a chance to rediscover an artist that many people had lost track of, and in fact, literally had lost track of. People did not know where she was for many, many years, at least the art world didn't. And so it's an interesting, you know, exhibition to perhaps reappreciate an artist. She was sort of an abstract artist mm-hmm. in the 1970s who might deserve a closer look than she really got during her lifetime.
Yeah, this is so interesting. I never heard of this artist, but the exhibit is called Mobile Images. It has 80 pieces. And what's so interesting is it has photographs, it has letters. She even has items from a fashion line, because apparently she was a seamstress as well and had come to New York from Jamaica to study fashion. So she has, you know, she's
I like that angle.
Yeah, she
Did you see some of the pieces?
Yeah. And, you know, I love fashion. So it's just, it was just so interesting how she was able to, you know, express herself and so with so many different types of art.
And there are personal artifacts in there. And part of sort of reconstructing this story is not just finding her art, but reconstructing her as a person, right? The sort of the legend of the artist. Mm-hmm. And there, I think there's always an appeal.
Like, why did she go? Why did she disappear? Right. Like, there's so many questions about.
Right. Whether it's, you know, and there are examples of this through history, slightly different than this, but Salinger or Van Gogh, people who maybe weren't appreciated in their time or kind of disappeared at the height of their popularity. Those enigmatic artists. And there's always a public fascination in trying to put that puzzle back together. Mm-hmm. I'd never heard of her either, but I'm very eager to see this show now. And I saw some of the works and they looked fascinating. They were very, very interesting compositions.
Yeah, and bold and very interesting shapes. It'll be there through December.
Speaking of bold art, story number three. This is a good one,
so,
folks.
So there's a cool new interactive art exhibit that is coming to Dilworth Plaza that allows you to, get this, conduct your own composition of water and sound. The Center City District, they sent out the announcement this morning. We got it to our inbox. So I want you to imagine yourself.
I'm imagining.
As a conductor for the day, you're standing in Dilworth Park behind a little podium. You have a wand in your hand, and your hand gestures actually direct the water that is coming from the Dilworth Park fountain in real time.
Look at that.
I mean,
it's so cool.
And the exhibition is called Water Orchestra. It was conceived by a trio of groups from Montreal who drew inspiration from Disney's Fantasia. You remember the part where Mickey Mouse is conducting the movement of the shooting stars and clouds
and birds. Sorcerer's
and
Apprentice. Yeah.
And so you actually get to conduct the water through the Sorcerer's
Apprentice.
You
get your own magic wand.
It's so cool.
I'm very excited for this. By the way, if you don't know Dilworth Plaza, it's right outside City Hall.
Exactly.
So very prominent location where we are giving the citizens of Philadelphia the chance to control the water. So my first thoughts were, this is really cool.
Uh-huh.
My second thought was, oh no, interactive art in Center City. What could possibly go wrong? Hopefully they've got some good guardrails mm-hmm. on this thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I am very interested to see what the creative Philadelphians do with the power to control the fountains.
I wonder what those hand gestures will look like. And by the way, it opens, it debuts September 5th. So it's pretty soon.
Yeah, pretty soon. By the way, this is, I think, the second big interactive art thing in Center City.
Yeah.
In recent vintage.
Mm-hmm.
After the Portal.
We remember the Portal.
The Portal, I would say, overall, we mostly passed the test on that one.
Mm-hmm.
It was eventually stripped for parts by
some people.
Vandals. So it wasn't perfect, mm-hmm. but for a while it seemed that people did a good job interacting with the park.
And then
they brought it back.
Were playing chess and all that. So,
the portal. So I think we earned the chance to step up to this Fantasia water thing. By the way, for folks who don't know, the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Oh, yes.
They recorded Fantasia mm-hmm. originally, the Sorcerer's Apprentice and all of that. It's a cool history link here. And the orchestra, directed by Yannick Nézet-Séguin, again, is going to do, I think on September 11th, a special performance at this special interactive art piece.
So I would want to see the professional do it. And then I would want to do that because he's going to come and, you know.
If they really wanted to draw the masses out, by the way,
because mm-hmm.
They have a certain playlist of songs that you can conduct to. They should have put Fly Eagles Fly in there. Just slip that right
fly
in.
Fly that in
yeah.
there.
Then you would have had a whole scene.
Avi's making suggestions.
Just a few suggestions.
You never know who's ever listening.
I'm not an artist. I'm not an artist. I'm not a visionary.
But you are an Eagles
fan. I'm a simple man, but I can still make a couple of humble suggestions. Okay, coming up in our main segment today, we're going to talk about the economy, Cherry. Going to ask folks, how you feeling right now about the economy? Are you spending, saving, changing your financial habits? Call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org, and you must stay tuned to Studio 2 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Our beloved producer, Debbie Builder, put this show together today. And last week, with some exasperation, Debbie sent all of us a screenshot of four recent news headlines that were about the same government report.
From Barron's, consumer spending is starting to crack.
From Quartz, consumer spending rose in June.
From Bloomberg, U.S. retail sales surge in broad advance.
From Fortune, the economy enters its budget shopping era.
And here's the headline from us. We're confused.
Yes, we are very confused. Is the U.S. economy vulnerable? Strong? Strong, but with vulnerability creeping around the corner? Well, we are going to examine these questions from every angle today, and we'll do so with the help of Patrick Harker, former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, and Rowan Distinguished Professor at the Wharton School. Thanks so much for being here in Studio 2.
It's great to be back.
Yes, and let's also welcome back to the program Heather Long, Chief Economist at Navy Federal Credit Union. Heather, thanks so much for being here.
Hey, thanks. I'm jealous I'm not in Philly to try out that music.
That's right.
It's really cool.
I'm going to have to make a trip.
You got to book a ticket.
You got to come. Yeah. You got to come. And for our listeners at home and elsewhere, here's our question of the day. How is the economy feeling for you right now? Are you spending? Are you saving? Or are you changing your financial habits? We ask you to join the conversation. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, keep those comments coming in the live chat.
Matt, by the way, says, spending less, kind of nervous due to so much uncertainty, shocked at prices of certain things. So Matt's feeling a little bit negative. However, consumer sentiment seems to be improving. Again, it's all very confusing. So I ask you, Patrick Harker, I come up to you at the cocktail party. Yeah. I know you know a lot about the economy. I say, Patrick Harker, describe the American economy to me right now. What do you tell me at this cocktail party?
Confusing.
Confusing. We agree.
It is. So if you think of the period we're in, this word uncertainty shows up a lot.
Yeah.
If you read the minutes of the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee, if you read the speeches of my former colleagues, that word shows up time after time after time. We are in a very uncertain time. It starts with the fact that we don't really know what the policies are. Mm-hmm. Some policies have been firmed up. The big, beautiful bill has been firmed up. But even there, the implementation of it provides some uncertainty. Tariff uncertainty is just causing not just consumers, but in particular businesses, a lot of headaches. They just simply don't know how to plan. I mean, what I heard over and over again, I continue to hear from business contacts, is you tell me what the rules are. Just tell me what they are, and I'll figure out how to work in that environment. But if you
even
keep changing the rules on me,
yeah.
I can't plan. Yeah. I can't. As a result, I'm going to hold back on investment. I'm going to hold back on hiring. I'm just going to wait.
Yeah. And what are the typical, Patrick, what are the typical markers that you look at to give you some guidance? And given all the uncertainty on the rules, how are those markers faring?
Yeah, they're choppy. I mean, if you look at the data, and Heather can speak to this too. And by the way, Heather, it's great to be with you this afternoon. It's been a while. They're telling a mixed pitch signals that are coming from all this data. We're seeing housing, you're starting to see for the first time in a long time, a lot in certain markets, there are a lot of houses for sale. This is highly unusual, not necessarily in our market, but in other markets around the country. You're starting to see, we've already seen low and moderate income consumers really struggling. Now, they've been struggling for a while. It's starting now to creep into higher income consumers. They are sitting and waiting. This is a really important time right now. It's back to school shopping time.
Huh. Yeah.
And why is that so important?
Oh, it gives you a signal of where the consumers are in terms of what they're willing to spend. one of our contacts, a great company in this district, the third district of the Philly Fed, is Crayola. A significant, a huge amount of their sales happen in back to school time.
Everybody's buying the crayons.
Not only they are buying, the teachers are buying it, schools are buying it. Well, do you buy the nice high-end markers that have the nice smell to them? Or do you buy the cheaper markers?
Or no markers at
all.
Yeah.
That tells you a lot about what the mindset of the consumer is.
Speaking of markers, what markers in the economy are you looking at, Heather Long? What is telling the story to you right now? And maybe you could even split it up. Maybe there's a data point that, that feels very hopeful to you, one that feels very worrisome to you. What are those markers for you, Heather Long?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm glad that Pat brought up low and middle income consumers. The way that I square all those headlines that Sherry was reading out is we're really back to this K-shape or bifurcated economy where the top is generally doing pretty well. And the statistic that always I keep in the back of my head is the top 10% of Americans drive roughly almost half of spending in the United States. And so the fate of the overall economy, those statistics that people like me are talking about and are reported in the headlines, the GDP and the consumer spending and the retail sales, a lot of that will be driven by the fortunes and the fate of the top 10, maybe 20% of Americans. And, you know, things look pretty good for them. The stock market's back at record highs. And if you look at sentiment surveys, those folks are not as worried about inflation. It's really striking to see versus what we see at Navy Federal Credit Union. You know, we're very much serving the middle class and moderate income Americans, obviously a lot of veterans. And, you know, we see signs of that worry. We see a lot of spending growth for families that are $170,000 income a year and above. We see a lot of caution for families that are in the middle class. You know, a lot of people are saving more in their savings account. Not in their savings, but in their checking account. Mm-hmm. They are literally holding more cash in their checking account right now because they're nervous. You know, they're nervous. Am I going to keep my job? Is the inflation, the uncertainty that Pat was talking to? And so that's how I keep in mind that, sure, if you ask me how is the economy doing at the cocktail party, Avi, I think I would say it's solid, but there's real pockets of pain. And we got to pay attention to those pockets of pain.
Yeah. And Andrea says on Facebook, A whole lot less spending and always saving. I want to sort of follow up with you, Heather, and talk about the ripple effects of this. Like, if you think about if people are keeping the money, they're sort of like keeping it in their checking account, they're afraid to spend. What are the ripple effects of that we will start to see if this continues?
Some of it we're seeing already in the sense that you know, we're thinking that this year is probably going to be 1.5% growth, you know, give or take. That's down from 3% last year. Now, it's not a recession. We're not talking about a negative number, but you can see we're talking about half the amount of growth potentially that we had in 2023 and 2024. So that's the obvious ripple effect. I think you're also starting to see this huge, I call it the frozen job market. If you are in a sector that isn't healthcare, or education, technically state and local government, but it's basically teachers and law enforcement, police and firefighters. Those are like the only sectors hiring. And it's been that way for months now, certainly the first 6 months of the year, I'd argue almost 12 months now. And so you can see that worry. We're also seeing an interesting trend. I talk a lot to our frontline workers, you know, people every day in those bank branches who are seeing folks come in or picking up the call centers. Everybody texts now. Excuse me. Everybody texts messages. But you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm old. But, you know, it's interesting. We start to see this trend. I call it job or pay downgrading. And what I mean by that is people are still employed. That's why the job numbers aren't totally tanking. But so many people are telling us, you know, I used to get a lot of overtime hours and now I don't. And that really hurts my budget, you know, or I used to get like if I was driving Uber or Uber Eats or something, you know, they used to do a lot of those promotions. You drive 40 rides a week or this many hours, you know, you'll get an extra $200 or something. And people aren't getting that anymore. So it's not that they have no job, but, you know, you can see why their finances are more strained and more tight when you were expecting a couple of extra $100 a week from overtime or bonuses or you name it.
Sure.
So all that stuff, it's at the edges, but you're starting to see that impact. Yeah, people aren't spending as much. you know, you can see that in a, on a real day-to-day basis.
By the way, we would love to hear your voice in this conversation. How is the economy feeling for you right now? Are you spending, saving, changing your financial habits? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org. John from Princeton says, I went down to the Jersey Shore and took back roads this weekend. So many people had cars on their lawns for sale. Cars on the lawn. Yes, we are in trouble. That's John's perspective from Princeton, New Jersey. In Heather's answer, she mentioned the education and the healthcare sectors. Yeah. Now, looking at this from our regional perspective, Pat Harker, those are two industries that really dominate here, in my understanding. So perhaps we're getting a somewhat warped sense of the economy, just looking at it from a Philadelphia perspective right now. Or how does that affect the way Philadelphians are feeling?
Yeah, so the Philly Fed's put out an initiative called the Anchor Economy Initiative, where the Fed collected data in 524 regions around the U.S. and multiple years of data on the economic impact of EDS and MEDS, educational institutions and healthcare institutions, on the economy. And they actually have a score, a reliance index, on how reliant the region is on those institutions. Philadelphia as a region is a 1.28. That is 28% higher than the national average.
So very reliant. Yeah.
The city is a 1.4.
Oh, boy.
I mean, very reliant. Boston is similar. A lot of major cities have this kind of reliance because of the dominance of EDS and MEDS. This is a real risk right now. Mm-hmm. If you think about what's going on, lots of changes that higher ed's having to go through and healthcare is having to go through, whether it's the Medicaid cuts or just the cutting in the recent bill of the support for graduate education and loans for graduate education. You can keep going down the list, but this is at cutbacks in NIH grants. I mean, this city in particular, this region, is very biotech oriented, as we know. And that is starting to cut back. You're seeing number of PhD students are being cut in half in some of the programs around the city. You're seeing other cutbacks happening. That not only has an immediate effect on the employment of those individuals, but it will have a long-term impact on the economic growth of this city and the country. This is the seed corn. This is the innovation engine that drives our economy. And when you cut that research back, you lose the future. You lose the future growth.
Yeah, and a quick follow-up. And by the way, Fish1999 on YouTube says, America's economy is unstable because of our leadership. That's Fish1999 on YouTube. And I wanted to ask you about the impact of DOGE cuts, because we're talking about the cuts to higher ed. We're talking about the Medicaid cuts that are coming. But thousands and thousands of people across the country lost employment, life-sustaining employment. Yes. Can you talk about that? And how does that affect the jobs numbers that we've been seeing?
Yeah, so in terms of the overall economy and the overall labor market, well, clearly it's devastating for these families when they've lost their jobs. It doesn't have a huge impact on the overall employment situation in America. It's just the numbers aren't big enough. Mm-hmm. That's true in particular in this region. We don't have a lot of federal workers. We have some, but again, for those families, it's devastating. But for the region as a whole, or for the economy as a whole, it's not a huge number.
Right.
That said, there are spillover effects, right? So it's not only those individuals, but it's those individuals who were administering grants to nonprofits or research institutions and so forth. That multiplier effect can have a significant impact when you add all that together.
Right. Let's talk about tariffs real quick. Yale Budget Lab says Americans face a 20.6% effective tariff rate right now, highest since 1910. We have heard from so many economists over so many years, tariffs are a tax, they will slow economic growth, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess, Heather Long, then why doesn't it feel worse right now if we've got the worst, effective tariff, the highest effective tariff rate in 115 years, and yet the economy kind of seems to be bumping along here, at least okay. How do you explain that, Heather Long?
Yeah, it's the multi-billion dollar question. I will give you my best answer, and then I look forward to Pat's best answers on this. So my best answer is it's coming, but we haven't seen it yet because of inventory. Companies have done a really good job. They've, you know, they brought in a lot of stuff in March before the worst of the tariff hit. And normally in recent years, we've seen a lot of retailers, you know, carry about 3 months of inventory. And what we're hearing on various earnings calls and from executives is that they've imported about 3 to 5 months of inventory. And if anyone, you know, was just shopping the Amazon Prime Week or the Walmart Plus or the Target Circle deals, then you took advantage of that inventory buildup. You could almost see which items they had overstocked in their inventory just by looking at what had big price cuts. But it doesn't last forever. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you're starting to see those early signs. Now, they're very early signs, but, you know, I was joking to a colleague, you know, half joking, it's kind of, you know, it's a real deal that I hope you're not looking for curtains this summer, because linens are one of the items that right. has clearly run out of the inventory and is starting to see one of the big jumps, or some audio electronic equipment. You can see I'm using my old school headphones.
That's so right. We'll keep these microphones for a while. How about that?
You know, you get the idea. The other one that I think is kind of interesting. So I think it's been really an inventory story, but you know, you quoted that Budget Lab deal. You know, I'd visited, I'm from Pennsylvania as well, the middle part, and I went up to Erie and hung out for a while at a furniture manufacturer. And the reality is, you know, they showed me, they pulled out the bills like, hey, here's the tariff invoice that we just got from our supplier. But the reality is that the full tariff hasn't come through.
Right.
You know, there's been pieces picked off along the way. And like ConAgra, one of the big, you know, ag companies, food companies, just did their earnings. And I thought it was really interesting. They said this. They said, look, we're forcing our suppliers to eat about a third of the tariff.
Okay. You know, and so the pain's been spread out a little bit there. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And so, they, you know, so I thought, I just looking at somebody had run the latest numbers we got, is the Treasury collected a record $27 billion in tariff revenue in June. Now, that's a record, like you're saying, yeah, Avi. You know,
that's, we have to, that's a lot of money. Yeah.
How many years? But that's not 20%. If you calculate it, it works out to about a 9% tariff. And so you can see, literally see, that some of it hasn't come through yet, and some of it's being eaten by different parts, you know, of the chain. And
delay
the question
reaction.
On my mind, yeah, how long does this go? You know,
yeah, can you answer that, Pat Harker?
How long does it go?
Yeah. What's your response? Yeah.
Well, first I have to say, Yale Budget Lab's a great institution.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's also the Penn Wharton budget model.
Okay,
that's
my favorite.
Yeah. Heather's absolutely right. People front-load inventory. If you actually look at the Port of Long Beach, there's a great place to look. You saw for a while no ships were there. No containers were there because people had loaded up and then they were just sitting, waiting. Now it's full because there's a lull, right, in the implementation of the tariffs. So people are loading up with inventory as fast as they can. That doesn't last forever.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing stories all across the economy, whether it's steel and aluminum. You think, okay, that affects cars. It also affects the can that's sitting on the shelf at your grocery store. It's not a lot of money that increased the price, but it's going to increase prices. You talk to construction, especially home builders. I've talked to home builders, and some of the softwood they use, it comes from Canada. Mm-hmm. A lot of it comes from Canada. And they can't easily just turn on a dime and use something else. In fact, if they try to do that, they have to re-spec the house. That is, they have to rewrite the specs for the building of the house. That's a huge cost to them. So they're eating some of the tariff right now and passing some of that along. The issue is we just simply don't know what the final tariffs will be.
Right.
Right. If we knew that, we could plan and companies could plan. But it changes every single day. That's what's driving people crazy right now.
Yeah. And Patrick, a lot of people think that Trump will just not go through with it, and that he wants to, this is all negotiation tactics, that these high tariffs that he's been threatening won't actually happen. Your thoughts on that, and should people bank on that?
So that's true. We don't know. You know, he may be using this as a negotiating tool. That's all true. But it's the uncertainty of just simply not knowing which causes people to just hold off, right? Except unless you have to do the project, or the project's so obvious that you're going to do it, like data centers right now. Data centers and the steel going into data centers, they're paying the cost of the steel. to get these data centers up, no matter what. Same thing with the electrical grid and so forth. But other projects, if I don't have to do it, if I don't have to do a plant expansion right now, why would I do it?
Yeah.
I mean, I just want to wait.
And I wanted to ask you a quick question, Heather. Is there an area where consumers are spending more money, where it is very clear that the prices have gone up in these areas? What are those areas?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll be curious what Pat says. I've been calling it the summer of the mini splurge. And what I mean by that is people are still, you know, they're going out with their families or their friends to restaurants. We're seeing pretty robust spending in restaurants. They're still doing sporting goods and hobby type purchases. So stocking up on those fall and summer stuff for their kids and then the sports realm. So you see a lot of those mini splurges. I guess you could think about it like instead of booking the trip to Europe, they're booking the trip to King's Dominion or Six Flags or one of those, you know, fun days or weekends out. So in that sense, it's good that, but you can see that it's not the revenge spend era of a summer or two summers ago for most Americans. The areas that we are seeing the tariffs start to come through, you know, Pat mentioned steel, and that one really filters through the entire economy right away. I'd mentioned the curtains and the linens, audio electronic equipment, a little bit on toys and sporting equipment. But it's been, you know, it's been a little bit tough to see so far for a lot of people. And the good news is what's really saving a lot of family budgets is the fact that gas prices have stayed low.
Right.
So you've got some other areas that have come down and moderated. So you're not feeling the full effect of the shock.
Let me ask you, Pat Harker, about the bond market and why it matters, because I see smart folks like you and Heather talking about this. Of course, most of us are mostly paying attention to like the Dow, NASDAQ, whatever. But the expert types seem to be worried about this, talking about this. Explain why it matters and what the state of the bond market is right now.
Yeah. So Heather can speak to this as well. I mean, why do you care about the bond market? Because your mortgage, your adjustable rate mortgage, is directly tied to that interest rate, right, of a 10-year treasury or other treasuries. But let's use the 10 years. It's sort of the standard one we look at. So that's why it matters, because you, whether it's your auto loan or your mortgage, or it's tied to that. So the question is, what's going on with the bond market? I actually just put a letter to the editor into The Economist magazine this week talking about this a little bit. One of my colleagues, Rich Clarida, former governor of the Fed, had a column in The Economist, and I just commented on it. And one of my concerns, and actually it's a concern about really the Fed and the Fed's independence, is that people think the Fed can do more than it can do. The Fed controls one interest rate directly. The Fed funds rate, the federal funds rate. That's the rate that banks borrow from each other overnight. That is what the Fed votes on. That's the one rate. The rest of the rates, the one-year treasury, the five-year treasury, the market decides that. Now, the Fed can influence that.
What's the market saying about those bond markets?
Yeah, right, well, let's go back a little bit to September of 24.
Yeah.
We cut interest rates 100 basis points, 1%, the Fed funds rate.
Yep.
What happened to the 10-year by January 2025? It went up 100 basis points, 1%.
And that tells us what?
It tells us, first of all, the Fed's not in control of that. There is political pressure on the Fed to say lower rates. They're not talking about the Fed funds rate. They're talking about your mortgage rate.
Right.
Well, just think about what happened. The Fed cut and the 10-year went up. That's not what the people think they want or the Fed can do. That has a direct impact, though, on... In my view, one of the things I'm worried about is the independence of the Fed. If people think you can do more than you actually can, then you just always disappoint.
Yeah.
Right? And that's where we are right now. People think the Fed can control all this. It can't. There are reasons why it's going up, and we can talk about those.
Yeah.
And well, I would love to. Maybe we have to take a break right now. But yeah, I think that's still, I'm still trying to understand why You know, I'm just read a little quotation here. Sell-off in government debt recently pushed Treasury yields higher, leaving the 30-year yield above 5% for the first time since May.
Right. We can talk about that.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand why that's happening. Of course, we want to get your thoughts on what the president's been saying about Jerome Powell, because I know you've got some special insight there. So we're going to do all of that on the other side of this break.
Yes, and we want to invite you to call in 888-477-9499. How is the economy feeling for you right now? Let us know. Studio2@WHYY.org. We'll be right back.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
I'm Cherry Gregg. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the latest on inflation, tariffs, jobs, housing. And we're asking you, our listeners, how you're feeling about the economy right now. Are you spending? Are you saving? Are you changing your financial habits? Give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, drop those comments in the live chat.
Wharton Professor Patrick Harker is with us in studio. He is the former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. And on Zoom, we've been talking with Heather Long, chief economist at Navy Federal Credit Union. And just to finish up what we were talking about before the break, so the Treasury yields higher,
right.
Sort of why, and especially right. Because you said like the Fed did what it did, and the reaction is obviously not what the people who want the Fed to continue lowering rates was. So then what's happening?
Yeah, it's supply and demand.
Okay.
So if you have more and more supply of something and soft demand or just constant demand, what happens? The price goes down.
Yeah.
So the price of the bonds go down, and that's inversely related to the interest rate. Another way of thinking about it is to entice people to buy that bond, you have to have a higher interest rate. So what we're seeing is the government continuing to issue lots and lots of debt, right? And the world at least is holding in there for now and buying it. But that's also not guaranteed, right?
There's lots and lots of debt, and there's not new people clamoring to buy that debt.
Yeah, it's not being absorbed at the rate it is being absorbed.
Is that as worrisome as
price,
it seems to me? I don't know. That seems worrisome.
Well, yes. I think that Heather can speak to this. I think the long run issues, we've talked a lot about what's happening in the economy today and the issues people are facing today. There's a longer term issue. We have an unsustainable path in terms of the federal budget and federal debt. Mm-hmm. And this is true, by the way, globally. We're seeing everybody loading up on debt. This will come to roost. Something will have to break sooner or later.
Yeah.
Some of my colleagues think it's sooner than, say, I do, but we need to start to address this. And we keep kicking the can down the road. Yeah. We refuse to deal with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to, over the past few weeks, I want to talk about this public pressure on the Fed right now. You know, President Trump has ramped up the pressure on Reserve Chair Jerome Powell. He has publicly blamed him for the high interest rates and a sluggish housing market. And so, Pat, I know you know the culture of the Fed. What's the risk when you have a sitting president sort of pushing the Fed chair in this kind of way? Does it actually influence decisions?
Well, I can't speak for my colleagues. This is the old line we used to say at the Fed, but it's true. I can only speak for myself. It did not influence my decision making at all.
Mm-hmm.
The Fed is independent for a reason. It does things that are often not what people want, like when we raise rates. Right. That's not the old take the punch bowl away. Mm-hmm. As Martin said, we're taking the punch bowl away just when the party gets started because we want to tamp down inflation. So that's the fear, that we're not actually at our 2% target yet.
Yeah.
We're close, but we're actually seeing some signs of this creeping up. And if these tariffs kick in, there's a debate about whether they're transitory, that is one time and then it doesn't matter, or they're going to be more long lasting. That is a real risk. So the Fed has to act to keep inflation under control and try to continue to have a healthy job job market.
And so what would be the conditions? Because, you know, you have this public pressure. People are seeing this.
Yeah.
What are the conditions that the chair will be looking for to make the determination on whether to lower the interest rate?
Again, if we're not seeing inflation spike or go up, but stay flat or go down, and we start to see some deterioration in the job market, then that would cause you to want to lower rates. But my point I made earlier is really important.
Mm-hmm.
What the president and others care about is not the Fed funds rate. They care about the 10-year treasury, the 30-year treasury.
Yeah.
And that is not directly control the Fed. So even if the Fed lowered the Fed funds rate, it is not a given that those other rates would move in lockstep.
The doomsday scenario mm-hmm. that people talk about a lot, at least the folks that treasure the independence of the Fed, is that Trump steps in and removes Powell somehow. Mm-hmm. But look, his term's going to be up anyways, and he could still then appoint someone who's perceived at least as a loyalist. We don't have to say the exact names, but they're out there.
Sure.
If that's what happened, that sort of B scenario where Powell just leaves because the term's up and then he appoints someone that is perceived as a loyalist, what does that do to the Fed and for an investment that's drawn in by perceived right. stability?
So I think this is really important. When the Federal Open Market Committee meets, the chair convenes that meeting, the chair votes in that meeting, but he or she is not the only vote.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
And there are staggered terms of both presidents and the governors that would live on. So even if the chair changed, mm-hmm. It's not a given.
It wouldn't be a fatal blow, you're saying.
It's not a given that everybody will just get in line with the chair.
Sure.
There have been periods in the Fed's history where there's been significant opposition to what a chair might want to do. That hasn't been true in recent years, but that could occur. I mean, these are independent people, independently minded people who are going to vote their conscience.
And so how do we sort of avoid politicizing? Because it seems like the chair has been politicized. How do you shift away from that? Given that this is a consensus building situation,
yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah.
not just one person making these decisions.
So this is one of the things I'm most worried about is back to what I said earlier. People think the Fed can do more than it can actually do. What we need to do is be very clear. This is what the Fed can do. This is what the Fed can't do. We can't solve all the problems that we have in the economy with the Fed. We need the fiscal side of the house, Congress and the executive branch, to do their part. And I think the Fed, to protect the Fed, we've got to stay in our lane and not wander out of it and not have people think we can do more than we can actually do.
By the way, just today in the New York Times, Ben Bernanke mm-hmm. and Janet Yellen wrote an opinion piece. It reads in part, the Fed's credibility, its perceived willingness to make hard decisions based on data and nonpartisan analysis is an important national asset. It is hard to acquire and easy
Absolutely.
To lose.
Absolutely. Amen.
And Heather Long, you've been listening to this conversation. Would love to get your thoughts on all of this as well. In some ways, I do wonder sometimes if because there is a person, a chair to talk about, mm-hmm. we maybe focus a little bit too much on yep. this particular issue because it's an easy political football to bat about. It's easy for the panelists on CNN mm-hmm. and us to talk about,
man,
right?
Yeah.
Right. It's an accessible thing to talk about. Big picture economy. Is this really, really important, the sort of fate of the Fed chair and what happens over the next year in that space? Or do you wonder if perhaps it is a little overblown by the folks like us?
Well, you're asking someone who's in the economic space, so I'm going to vote with the economists here for sure and say it's not overblown.
Yeah.
Let me just put it in real terms. Like, what does this mean for the middle class? Pat said it, as part of his remarks, but I think it bears repeating. One of the topics we've been debating at my organization is the word on the street has been rates higher for longer, right? They've stayed at these high levels. The mortgage rate has been close to 7% for 2 years now, and that's a real strain on families. So many young people really want to buy a home and cannot right now. But if we start compromising the Federal Reserve and people's belief that the Fed will keep inflation under control, that the Fed will remain independent and make the tough choices when needed, you can call that higher forever.
Yeah.
There will be a risk mm-hmm. premium there. And that scares people. When I say that to our real estate lending team, they go, oh my gosh, because they know who they deal with and who they talk to every day who are coming in trying to get a mortgage loan or an auto loan. And, you know, as many places have reported, a lot of people are very desperate to see a rate cut right now. You know, they bought a home in the last year or two believing that those rates would come down. So, so I think this could be very real for people. And, you know, Pat sort of said it, I'll reiterate it. Even if the next Fed chair that's appointed and confirmed by the Senate does need to be confirmed by the Senate, and we have seen the Senate reject some nominations by this president in his first term, for instance, so it's not a given. But, you know, even if there's just a perception that things are losing independence and that are being compromised, there will be a market impact. There will be a cost to that change. And so, but let me just also step back. Let me sort of pivot off your question, Avi, and say, you know, one of the things, look, you can hear Pat and I and the people who've been writing in, we're all worried about the bottom of the K. We're worried about the pockets of pain. You know, we're worried about the strain and the stress in the economy. But let me also lay out the case that things go better than expected.
Yeah, I would love to hear this.
Positive.
Because we did get predictions of a recession that didn't pan out recently, too. So sometimes things can get a little too
pessimistic. And I'm not Pollyanna. Like, I'm focused on the bottom of the K. But, you know, but I try to ask myself and stress test my thinking. And there is a world where, you know, look, we've just locked in the tax rates. You can argue if you like those tax rates we locked in or not in the big, beautiful bill, but there's certainty for business for the next 2 years, at least through the midterms and for Americans. You know, there's also now more certainty on the regulatory rollback, which many industries have been asking for. Again, you can debate if that's good or not. I've got my thoughts, but there is a surprising a lot more certainty than there was just a few weeks ago. And if we could just get to a place, and I know it's a big if, but if we could get to a place, say, by the end of the summer, where we're mostly locking in some of these tariff rates and we're locking them in around 15% instead of 30 or 50 or whatever the favorite number of the day is, people can live with that. You know, it's like Pat was saying, people can plan for that. Doesn't mean they're loving it, but you know, they can start to set plans. And so there is a case, and the big, beautiful bill adds a little bit of stimulus in the short term for later this year, early into next year, if we could lock in the tariffs a little bit, that you start to create, you start to unlock some of that business investment that's been sitting on the sidelines, maybe even a little hiring in some industries that have been frozen. And you know, these are big ifs. Maybe if we get a Fed rate cut in September or December, you know, maybe we start to unfreeze the housing market, which some have argued is in a recession right now. So now these are all big ifs. I feel like I'm doing a lot of ifs here.
Yeah. But it's basically taking that word uncertainty and turning it into certainty. More or less.
Yeah. And you know, there is a glide path. Yeah. I mean, frankly, that's why the market is at record high.
Sure.
They're seeing that glide path.
And we only have a couple more minutes left, but I wanted to read this. Aaliyah says, I've always saved, but saving even more. I purchased my car out of a lease because of pending tariffs. I will not be leasing a new car every 3 years. We had plans to move. We need the space, but we will stay put for now because I'm scared of what the economy is going to do. And so I want to take a moment and just talk to consumers, to the average American who's hearing what you're talking about, Heather, hearing what you're talking about, Patrick, trying to decide what moves to make. They can't plan because there are some, you know, things that are still uncertain. Mm-hmm. What would you advise them to do? You know, should they be saving more? Should they not move? Should they not? I mean, they're trying to plan their lives. Kids are going to go back to school. What would be your advice to them? And Patrick and of course, Heather, too.
I think it's really context dependent. If they're in a job that they feel is stable and secure, and that's the biggest source of their income, of course, is their job by far for most Americans. It's the only, for most people, source of income. If they feel that that's going well, then they can take a little risk. But they also have to know what their own risk tolerance is, right? How much risk are they willing to live with? What can they sleep with at night, right? So I think that really depends on the individual. There's no one size fits all because it depends on where you are in the income spectrum, where you are on the job security spectrum, and so on.
Yeah. And your Heather, your thoughts there?
Yeah, we've been talking in my organization about the be prepared mentality. If you can, this is a good time to be saving more, building up that cushion. You know, even if you have emergency savings, I know myself, I've beefed up my emergency savings, you know, keeping more like a 12-month instead of a 3 to 6 month emergency savings. And we're certainly seeing our members doing some more of that when they can. It's not always easy. But, you know, there could be some opportunities in 2026. For instance, that woman who wrote in, you know, Sherry, that you were talking about. No, is it the good time to buy a house right now? Not exactly. However, as you all were pointing out, we do have more homes for sale. We have finally crossed 1 million homes for sale listings on realtor.com for the first time since pre-pandemic. It's starting to turn into a buyer's market. And if the mortgage rate comes down, you know, by early 20 to mid 2026, that could be a really good time to pounce while you still have a lot of homes for sale, you know, and people aren't quite, not as many buyers. They will eventually come out.
It says
out.
Be ready. So it's sort of like a wait ready. And get ready for what's to come.
That's good advice.
Yeah. That's my take.
Right. And so if uncertainty freezes things and people are sort of sitting there maybe with some opportunity when that certainty, if it ever sets in, that could create a little trampoline effect. Absolutely. Okay. Well, look, we could talk about this a lot more, but let me thank everyone because if I didn't do that, it would not be a complete show. I want to thank you, Patrick Harker, former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia and Rowan Distinguished Professor at the Wharton School, and promise you I will be using those Wharton models in the future. Thanks for being here, Pat Harker. And Heather Long, chief economist at Navy Federal Credit Union. Always a pleasure to have you, Heather.
Thank you so much.
And thanks to everybody who wrote in today. And thanks, of course, to our producers who put the show together, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer. Also thanks to Diana Martinez and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. Thanks so much for joining us, everybody. We will be back here same time tomorrow.